Welcome to Voices, the EISA podcast, the space for cutting-edge research in the discipline of international relations, and the audible companion to EISA, the European International Studies Association. This podcast sets the stage for deeper insights into award-winning papers, books, and theses, as much as it provides a room for the critical engagement with key concepts in political and sociological thought. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible. Please welcome our today's host, Polly Pallister-Wilkins, political geographer and associate professor at the University of Amsterdam and board member of the EISA.
Today we're flipping the script a little as we head into the summer break and talking to the voice of the podcast herself, Judith Koch. Judith just finished her PhD. Her thesis explores Brexit, not as a sudden shock, but as the result of decades of UK-European foreign policy relations. What if Brexit wasn't a bolt from the blue, but just the latest instance in a decades-long struggle between the UK and its European counterparts? In her work, Judith applies a radical historicist approach that traces the longer history of Brexit, all the way back to the Suez Crisis of 1956. Her work reframes Brexit as the collapse of a unique dynamic that has long sustained UK-European relations, challenging the usual story of the UK's 2016 decision to leave the EU. She has published in Global Political Economy and is currently working on her book. Beyond academia, she brings over a decade of broadcast journalism experience, mainly with Germany's public broadcaster, ARD, reporting from Cologne, Berlin, and London, mainly on politics. She holds a BA in journalism and political science from TU Dortmund and both an MA and PhD in international relations from the University of Sussex. Alongside her academic work, she offers media training for academics and has developed academic podcasts for different universities and research associations. Of course, including Voices! So, Judith, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This must be quite strange for you.
It is indeed.
Like she speaks. Okay, yes. So let's start at the beginning with the first question. And that is your choice of topic. Can you tell us what motivated you to spend years studying Brexit? Something most people in the UK and probably other parts of the world would rather forget.
Yeah, that's a fair point. So honestly, of course, this decision came out of curiosity, but also from kind of a sense of frustration with how one-dimensional many public, but even academic discussions of Brexit were. So at the time when I started my PhD, which was in 2019, I was actually covering the long saga of Brexit negotiations in London for Germany's first public broadcaster. And we traveled up and down the country, searching for the causes, talking to Brexiteers, Remainers, political elites, but also to voters, mainly in deprived areas, so in those UKIP voter stronghold areas. But all we found was, of course, something that only British people would be responsible for, so policy elites or citizens. And then looking at the academic work on Brexit, especially in political science, many of them focused on short-term or domestic reasons. So like plenty has been published on Brexit, so I'm just going to outline a few tendencies here. We saw that there were a lot of accounts that held a cultural backlash or economic deprivation responsible. But these analyses are based on voting patterns. And astonishingly, some accounts draw different conclusions based on the same set of empirical data. And then we have accounts that prioritize history and Britain's role as an awkward partner, its island geography, its imperial past, or the special relationship with the US, as the reasons for its traditionally distant attitude towards Europe or its stance as a so-called awkward partner in the community. And I think considering history isn't wrong per se, it's quite the opposite actually, but I think these accounts remain largely silent on what exactly this so-called exceptionalism is based on. So specificity is sort of emphasized, but not rigorously analyzed. So there's something missing here, both methodologically and theoretically. Another strand in the literature zooms in on British domestic politics, especially the decisions made by British leaders such as Thatcher, or more recently Cameron's so-called failure of statecraft leading up to the referendum. And while we also need politics or political agency, however, I think it's crucial to address also other agents from the EU sphere. So, and finally, of course, there are also IPE approaches that include capitalist dynamics into their analysis. And these have often argued that Brexit is really about broader pressures like globalization and economic shocks, not just British politics or history. Neo-Gramscian IPE scholars would, for example, say that Brexit reflects a breakdown in the alignment of material power, ideas, and institutions that previously underpinned Britain's EU membership. And Brexit is here basically seen as a counter-hegemonic movement challenging the EU's neoliberal common sense, if you want, and the broader project of European integration. But these accounts remain rather structural, and they also don't address agency. And of course, there's other IPE literature on Brexit, including scholars as Helen Thompson, Quaglia, James, Howarth, just to name a few, who have all offered important contributions by highlighting the specificities of the UK's financial system and the structural power of the city, its global orientation, legal frameworks, and centrality to European finance. And this is, of course, important. However, what I did in my research is basically to analytically integrate these different dimensions, because many accounts often overlook the historical specificity and tend to stay within a UK-focused or trans-historical framework. So essentially, my approach expands the analysis by considering first a wider range of agents, also including European agents. Second, it applies a long-term analytical lens. And third, it situates Brexit within the broader context of UK-European foreign policy and economic relations. So essentially, my research reframes Brexit as a foreign policy outcome other than a sudden rupture. So I understand Brexit as the result of long-term elite-driven crisis in UK-EC or EU relations, which means I look at both British and European elites, mainly France and Germany, but also at the Commission as the main policy-making body, stretching my analysis all the way back to the Suez Crisis of 1956. I think this long-term view really pays off because it allows me to see a distinct dynamic that kept Britain in the EU as long as it did. And this, I think, I want to highlight this because I soon realized that instead of asking why did Brexit happen, as everyone does or did at the time, we actually have to flip the question around. So what we must ask instead is, why did it take the UK so long to leave the EU? And if we take the step back, Brexit looks less like a sudden shock event and more like the result of decades of back and forth between the UK and Europe that was shaped by growing EU influence and deepening financial ties, something I will elaborate later on, and not just one referendum. So focusing only on Britain, like political elites, the electorate, or on big economic trends really misses the bigger picture. So to truly understand Brexit and perhaps also today's wider crisis of capitalism, I think it can be really helpful to see them as long-term co-created processes, so outcomes between multiple sides rather than sudden ruptures.
Okay, so you've described there Brexit not as this sort of sudden shock, but as the end point of a long process of disintegration going back decades, back to the Suez Crisis in 1956. What was the moment in your research when this sort of long view of Brexit really clicked for you?
So the long view on Brexit, I think, really clicked for me when I realized the tensions between Britain and Europe didn't just start with a 2016 referendum or the 1990s under Thatcher, or even EEC accession in 1973. As you said, my research leads back to the Suez Crisis, a moment of imperial decline, but also a turning point in the global financial order. So before seeking EEC membership, Britain tried to protect its sovereignty and financial system through alternatives like the Free Trade Area and the European Free Trade Area. which didn't work out. But then when Britain did pursue EEC membership, it faced repeated French vetoes, and the negotiation often actually revolved around nuclear concerns among France, the US, and Britain, and not really around membership. So this meant, first, that Britain entered the EEC without a clear strategy for key sectors, which set up a legacy of uneasy integration. And every push for deeper ties, from the Single European Act of 1986 to Maastricht, only intensified domestic tensions and Euroscepticism, especially among policy elites and key sectors. But I think the real aha moment for me was seeing this pattern, this antagonism that I kind of mentioned earlier, this antagonism of deeper integration alongside rising Euroscepticism playing out at different conjunctures. So the more Britain integrated into Europe, the more internal resistance grew, actually. A dynamic I call the integration paradox, which became especially pronounced with the ratification of the Single European Act in 1986. And if we look at what happened later down the line, of course, we see that the Commission tried to repeatedly please Britain by granting opt-outs and concessions from the 90s onwards. However, it seemed that these concessions actually deepened domestic skepticism rather than resolve it. So why was that? And what I found here was quite astonishing, because oftentimes these concessions actually worked in the opposite direction. While policy elites tried to retain their leadership credentials by negotiating them, for example, the opt-in into the social charter under Blair, they oftentimes had the opposite effect. So the long view really clicked for me when I saw this antagonistic dynamic, this integration paradox playing out. But when we then look at how Brexit happened, and to my mind, as I said before, this wasn't a shock, but more like the collapse of this dynamic that had been produced by decades of foreign policy interactions. So the question then was, why did it happen in 2016? So why the timing? Why not earlier? And I found the answer to this by looking at the historically grown entanglements between British and European finance. And these entanglements have a rather long history, because the rise of offshore finance had created lasting financial entanglements between the UK and Europe that would later influence British-European integration. And I think adding to that, this paradox basically was ultimately exacerbated by shifts in global finance after the global financial and the Eurozone crisis, and crucially by the rise of Eurosceptic hedge fund and asset managers who successfully leveraged this integration paradox and tensions that kind of underpinned European integration over time. And what was really helpful, or like what really inspired me here, was Benkett's and Bourgeron's work, Alt Finance, which became crucial, especially if I was to understand Brexit's timing. So in their book, they basically emphasized the influence of a relatively small group of asset and hedge fund managers who massively funded the Leave campaign, while the traditional banking sector instead actually preferred to remain. However, while their account really like brilliantly illustrates how Brexit gained a material basis, I think there's an important missing piece to the puzzle. Because first, the fact that the Commission wasn't able to grant further concessions in an environment of tighter fiscal restrictions really like impacted this relationship to quite a big extent. And second, the reason for why this Eurosceptic rhetoric fell on such fertile ground in 2016 remains unexplained. Because I wondered, how do we explain why the Leave campaign really resonated so strongly with voters in 2016? And to my mind, the answer must be found in this long buildup of contradictions and tensions that had emerged throughout 60 years of foreign policy formation. So, yeah, which is what I encapsulate with this integration paradox. And then, I mean, speaking of the literature that inspired my work, other than Benkett and Bourgeron, of course, the political Marxist literature that we probably talk about a bit later. I was also inspired by Helen Thompson's work on Brexit, but also on the broader literature on financialization and critical macrofinance, which is why my project went beyond IR historical sociology, actually, and was soon strongly influenced and also speaking to the IPE literature.
Yes, so sort of a question then about literature and about how you position yourself within the debate. So your thesis draws on geopolitical Marxism and applies radical historicism as a method. Now, for listeners who might not be familiar, and I include myself in this, how does this approach help you see the Brexit story differently?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So before I talk method and theory, I think it is again important to basically emphasize my alternative understanding of Brexit as a foreign policy outcome. So as only one instance within a long-term process that really made a big difference to my approach. So in my case study, I actually revisited key treaty settlements between the UK, West Germany, France, and the Commission, as I said, between 1956 and 2016. I drew on archival material, on diplomatic history, national and European archives, as I said, and also economic data. And I conducted this archival research by applying a political Marxist-inspired, agency-centered, radical historicist approach. Just quickly, political Marxism traces back to the work of Robert Brenner and Alan Wood and its most recent spin-offs by Sam Naffo and Benno Teschke. It refuses an understanding of capitalism as a structural, fixed, trans-historical system or economic framework within which agents just act or react. So instead, capitalism is understood as only coming into being by the creative responses agents develop facing market pressures, such as the constraints of profit maximization, competitive accumulation, etc., but also by geopolitical pressures. So there's an emphasis on agency and strategies that are rooted in social property relations. By the way, we have an excellent episode on political Marxism with Maya Pal, which everyone should check out to dig deeper. On that note, I'm sure the producer of this podcast will add relevant literature on that to the show notes as well. So, but what geopolitical Marxism essentially does is basically tracing the encounter of different foreign policy strategies. And it looks what happens if these interact. And this was obviously crucial for my research. And I think I should also add a few words on radical historicism that I used as a method, as I said. So let me start by saying that the radical in radical historicism means to essentially getting to the root of why things are the way they are under capitalism, but not by basically deriving them from overarching structures or a set kind of economic framework. But an agency-centered radical historicism always commits to putting agency at the forefront of the analysis. So a radical commitment to always analyzing through the lens of agency, regardless of any expectations of what they might or might not do, or any preconceived assumptions about the system and its structures. And importantly, this approach allows to trace counterintuitive agency as well and unexpected outcomes that often would otherwise get lost or be subsumed under broader capitalist dynamics and more structural Marxist approaches. This approach looks at the role of diplomacy, behind-the-scenes negotiations, trade-offs, both bilateral and multilateral. So for my approach, of course, organizing the rather massive amount of material I was confronted with was also crucial, and it helped here to isolate these key conjunctures, the European treaties, key economic settlements, to get a grip on the agents involved in these. Not only policy elites in the UK, Germany and France and the Commission, but I also looked at sectoral interests in Britain. Just a few words on the Commission, because that was actually quite interesting to see, because the Commission doesn't just orchestrate the different interests, but the Commission has agency itself, which is often anchored to some degree in the Commission President's domestic context. So by tracing these different agents' interactions, I saw first that oftentimes sectoral interests were somewhat disjunct from what was politically negotiated. And second, that many issues were actually resolved indirectly through what I call proxies. And I think it really also highlighted how different agents developed strategies that weren't always aimed directly at European integration, but still influenced it through these proxy actions and decisions that I just mentioned. And so by tracing these lineages of agency, as Samuel Naffo calls it, we sometimes detect the unseen, really. In my case, this was the building up of this distinct legacy that I mentioned earlier that came with every deeper step towards European integration. So Brexit no longer appeared as a sudden shock or isolated event. And beyond Brexit, I think this approach also offers certain benefits for other instances of foreign policy formation, because too often we rush to explain politics through immediate causes, overlooking the deeper long-term dynamics at play. So I'd say engaging with Brexit through this foreign policy lens and using this radical historicist framework offers two key contributions. First, I think the approach really challenges the view that foreign policy is just a series of isolated events. Instead, I argue that we have to examine long-term that gradual build-up of tensions and interests over time. And second, I think it highlights very well the lasting legacy of foreign policy decisions. And by focusing on the role of sectoral interests and policy elites shows how many strategies actually aimed at resolving issues unrelated to European integration, as I said, that ultimately backfired since true integration, was actually never fully achieved.
I've never been more interested listening to something about the European Union in my life.
I'm glad.
You know, normally I glaze over. Maybe that's a reason that Brexit happened. People just, make it sexy enough.
They didn't. But then, don't forget the supranational intervention of the Commission.
Or the hedge fund managers. Never forget them.
But not without the preliminary history, right?
It's all Anthony Eden's fault.
Maybe. He didn't know at the time.
He wasn't around for long, but he did a lot of damage. Only Liz Truss can, Anyway, from that we can see that your research does not only speak to IR, international relations, but also, of course, to the literature in international political economy. Can you tell us a bit more about how you speak to the IPE literature?
Yeah. So this research is basically an international historical sociology of Brexit, which is more, obviously the IR contribution. But it also contributes to the literature on financialization, especially European financial integration, and also to the growing literature of asset managerial capitalism. However, I think what it does, and this is probably the problem of a lot of mainstream IR and IPE theories who tend to focus on short-term events or treat states as isolated units, often assuming other factors remain constant. And I think these approaches really miss the bigger picture, the long-term, the cumulative dynamics and the complex ways domestic politics and supranational institutions interact over time. So what my research really does is going beyond also, thinking of neo-Gramscian accounts in IPE and the Amsterdam School. And although they offer valuable insights into transnational class formations and elite networks, which was also very crucial for my account, they often reduce agency to the preferences of certain capitalist groups and don't fully capture how diverse actors creatively strategize, especially what happens when these strategies interact. So what I really highlight here is the interaction of different strategies that cannot be read off certain capitalist interests or even political strategies by policy elites. So my research really pushes beyond these limitations while treating foreign policy as an ongoing contested social process rather than isolated events. And I think, this approach really encourages more context-specific analysis. And this is what I hope to contribute also to the literature in IPE.
Great, thank you. Can you tell us a bit more about where your research is headed now?
Yeah, absolutely. So the City of London and the wider UK financial sector played a crucial, if often behind the scenes, role in shaping Britain's relationship with the EU. And my research focuses on these, let me say, quieter dynamics that nevertheless have a major impact on political outcomes and ongoing relations between Europe and Britain, of course, but also if we wanted to understand the UK's position in the global financial system after Brexit. So currently in my research, I'm still very much interested in the city and the politics of European financial integration. And right now, I'm basically working on my book manuscript, but also on several spin-off articles based on my PhD. One essentially rethinks the Suez Crisis, building on Vanessa Ogle's amazing work on archipelago capitalism. And it's informed by IPE scholarship, but also draws on the urban geography literature. So I'm kind of playing around with that. Essentially, what this paper does is, because we usually think of Britain joining the EC in 1973 as a reluctant move after losing its empire and after these failed initiatives that I mentioned earlier, which is all true. But my research reinterprets that story. I show how Suez actually sparked a bold strategic transformation, turning London into a global financial powerhouse that soon connected to Europe. And I argue it was less about decline and more about deliberately reshaping power using London's financial muscle to secure a top spot in the European and global order. And also, I'm currently working in a collaboration with Alexis Drach, who's a historian from Paris 8, on a project about the Capital Markets Union, which, despite being on the EU's agenda since the 1960s, actually still hasn't come together, which is currently hotly debated again, and which has recently been rebranded as the Savings and Investment Union. What we actually do in this piece is, instead of blaming its slow progress on Europe's resistance to an American-style financial system, we're looking at how class divisions and conflicts among European elites, banks, stock exchanges, but also insurances, shape the whole progress over time, and how the Commission's talk of failure might actually serve the political purpose. So it's still work in progress, but we're excited to dig deeper.
Absolutely. Look, you're making it sound exciting. You're making like European finance sound exciting.
Thank you.
I mean, it actually is, you know, just gets talked about in a boring way usually. Okay. So I have some final questions for you, and we're going to pivot away from discussing Brexit maybe and the financial markets and insurance and how we're all completely fucked. Ed, you can keep that in. I don't care. You have just finished your PhD very successfully, I might add. Do you have any experiences or advice to share for other PhD students?
Yeah, I still kind of try to integrate the big loss that a submission and a successful completion, because I was expecting to spend some more weeks and months correcting my PhD's revisions. But what I did is basically I just cycled through Italy for almost a month and then did a language course in Italy. So I think talking to the more aged PhDs maybe, or the ones that are about to submit, I think really set up a solid plan for the time afterwards, because no one actually talks about, I mean, everyone is always, oh, amazing, never again, yes, you submitted. But it's actually quite a heavy thing to handle, I think, to kind of just completely let go of this thing that kind of basically dominated the best years of your life. But if you ask me what I would recommend to current PhDs, I think for me, what was really essential was having a life outside of academia. And it's crucial to choose a topic as well that you are prepared to commit to for 3 to 6 years, something you're ready to have a love-hate relationship with. And then, yeah, find friends that stay, especially if you have to live abroad and constantly meet new people. It's really, I think, very important to kind of have this solid base, wherever that might be. And by friends, I don't mean networking. It's about forming genuine friendships. A PhD can actually be quite overwhelming. So I think having the support system and also activities that ground you, which for me was a lot of outdoors related stuff.
I think that's really good advice. I mean, in recognizing that the PhD is important, but it's not the be all and end all of everything. And it's a part of your life and it's a project that you do, but it's not the whole of yourself. So that's really, really good advice, especially for then what happens afterwards, right? When the PhD is done and you need to have something that defines who you are that is not the PhD.
Yeah.
And so talking about what comes next, I think people can often find it difficult to think about, you know, what comes next after the PhD. So, you know, and you're talking about, you're working on these other things. What are your future projects? Where are you going now? Like, what do you want to work on going forward?
Yeah, so I am currently applying for different postdocs, but also jobs, like so many of us, I guess. And I think for my postdoctoral research, I'd be really interested in kind of looking a bit closer at what I mentioned earlier, contested processes of European financial integration, different projects with the approach that I do. But what I'm also doing, and I'm also deeply passionate about, and which is basically what I do at the moment, is bridging the gap between academia and the public. So I've worked in knowledge transfer and research communication since around 5 years now. I'm a journalist by profession, but I've also recently started to train academics in podcasting and media communication. And it's really fun. Like, this is actually a really great thing to combine with academia. And I also think it's really important because, yeah, let's be honest, the stakes are high. We're living through overlapping crises, political, environmental, economic, And academic insights are often more nuanced than what we get in quick media sound bites. While at the same time, it's sometimes difficult to kind of, I mean, obviously, as demonstrated, maybe in this podcast as well, it's sometimes difficult to kind of break down complex research in an accessible way. This doesn't mean by any means we shouldn't keep writing in complex terms for an academic audience. But if we don't find creative ways to communicate that knowledge, it just stays locked away in journals or in the ivory tower. So I think podcasts, public writing, workshops, they're all ways to make research useful and relevant, especially in a time when misinformation spreads so easily. And yeah, and this is what I'm trying to contribute at the moment.
That is so important, right? I mean, you know, we do. Academia is under attack. We're seen as out of touch. You know, we speak to ourselves in our echo chamber, in our ivory tower. And, you know, we do have a responsibility, especially those of us whose salaries are paid by, you know, our society's taxpayers, to actually make our output accessible, not to dumb it down, but to make it accessible. And I think podcasting is an excellent way. So yeah, podcasting is the way to go.
Exactly.
as evidenced by the EISA Voices podcast. Jingle.
Where did that just come from?
I don't know, but that was perfect.
Is the producer actually with us?
I don't
know.
Hello? It's the AI. It's an AI.
Thank you for listening. Please find all information on today's interview guests and host in the show notes. Voices, the EISA podcast, is available on all established podcast platforms. If you liked it, subscribe now. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.